Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
For a long time, airlines, United in particular, have bullied us. The apology? I thought it was staged. I think you ought to make it sound like you mean it. I didn't get that feeling.
Oh, I do. Oh, I think they really mean it now. You don't think United Airlines isn't sorry? It's 110 on WGN. Hi, it's John Williams. We're in the Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. I'm here till 3 o'clock. I'm glad you're listening. This story about the mother of all bombs, which has been dropped on Afghanistan, is the sort of thing that gives you pause. 21,600-pound GPS-guided munition. According to CNN, the largest in our arsenal, save a nuclear weapon, was dropped in what is believed to be a series of tunnels in ISIS strongholds. What does this mean? What did it do? What are the consequences? I don't know. That's just part of that evolving story. We'll continue to follow that this afternoon. Among other things, closer to home, that thoroughly entertaining press conference that took place today. Ryan Burrow was there from WGN Radio News. Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Doing all right. Thoroughly entertaining if you caught the first maybe 20 to 30 minutes of it, but it kept going on and on and on.
I noticed that, and I thought it sort of transitioned between this is interesting and entertaining to this is really entertaining to him, but maybe not to everybody else.
At some point, someone needed to pull the hook out. We had a situation like that actually a couple summers ago with then-candidate Donald Trump when he was at the City Club of Chicago, where literally he stayed and answered any question. I mean, we could have floated at him, and that was kind of the scenario here too. I think Wall Street Journal got about four or five questions in, and at the end he was just kind of repeating himself.
All right, so talk to me about what we're talking about.
All right, so we know about this passenger on Sunday who was yanked off a United Airlines flight. Dr. David Dow was forcibly removed. They needed to clear four seats for some ongoing crew members, and he refused to get up out of his seat. So they brought some Chicago Department of Aviation officers on. They yanked him off. The video went viral. We see his bloodied face. We hear some of the things he's saying, including just kill me.
Yeah, he gets back on the plane and says that.
He does.
What is that?
Well, we'll get to that when the attorney starts speaking. But we know that Munoz came out and essentially said this should never have happened. Right. So this is the CEO of United and actually kind of taking some of the blame for this and saying they're looking and changing things from their perspective. Now, flash forward to today, and this was the press conference, the first in regards to the Dr. Dow situation. This is new attorneys that he's hired, as well as his daughter who lives in Barrington.
Thomas Demetrio. His daughter is his attorney now?
No, she was just out there. Just as a family member,
I saw her
came
speak.
Out to
she seemed reasonable, pleasant. She wasn't odd, and everything about him is odd.
She talked glowingly about his character, talked about what a good person he is, talked about how hard this has been for them and how shocked she was about some of the
fallout. What was the media assembly like?
It was at the Union League Club of Chicago. They had, it was packed. It was CNN. It was NBC. It was ABC. It was all the nationals. Wall Street Journal was there. Bloomberg was there. You know, everyone was there because this is not only just a local story, but this is a national interest story. It's a business story. There's so many different things tied into this.
It's an international story,
absolutely,
too. I understand this is playing very big in China.
You know, which is interesting because we learned something today. He is not Chinese. He is actually Vietnamese. He came to the United States in 1975 following the fall of Saigon, and his attorney said that he actually compared this and said it was worse than that attempt to get out of Vietnam.
Well, I don't know what that was like for him, so I won't comment on that, but that seems to be a stretch to me. I'll bet most people who had to flee Saigon would say it was worse than being asked to leave a United Airlines flight.
Well, you know, let's put it in perspective this way. We did get some of the injuries that were described. Number one, concussed. Pretty bad concussion. That's at least what the attorney says. Number two, broken nose. Three, broken teeth. 4, some sinus issues as a result of this. This is all from getting dragged out of there and presumably hitting his head on some of the chairs or knees or whatever was in his way. He says, and we'll get back to what you had said earlier about the kill me, the attorney says he doesn't even remember that. He says that after he was dragged off the first time, he got back on, doesn't remember any of that.
So now he's kind of dopey, got a ringer-dinger going, and he just wanders onto the plane all bloody and says, kill me.
The idea is kind of like, you know, a boxer who's ready to go down. It's just, you know, not really thinking sensically. So
what is Demetrio asking for? Is this a civil suit? And if so, how much?
He is a civil attorney. We do not know at this point. In fact, if you tried to pin him down, he said, are we going to sue? Probably. No, we don't have like a date or anything like that. Now, this could mean two things. Number one, which he said, they're trying to amass as much information as they can, recorded videos, documents, things of that nature. They want to get, and they're going to be in court on Monday, they're trying to get all that stuff protected so that United or the CDA or whomever can't go and delete it or, you know, find some other use for it or something like that. Number two, they want to take as much time as they can to collect and gather all that information. And number three, this could potentially be just a, you know, showing their cards to eventually settle. You know, hey, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to take this to a lawsuit.
Well, that's what I thought.
What
is the purpose of this show? I said that, I think, to Steve Bertrand a little while ago, or I know it was during our Mincing Rascals podcast. I said, why in the world do you have to have a press conference before you even have a lawsuit? I think you've just answered that question. It forces their hand if you want to settle. You want to get into this three-ring circus with us? You want to see your value drop even more? Good. Let's have a drawn-out civil proceeding. That'll be a lot of fun
exactly.
for you.
Exactly. And that's, you know, one thing United doesn't want is we saw the fallout Tuesday alone once that video went viral. So, you know, and what's interesting is we are seeing a little bit of a back and forth now between Dr. Dow's people as well as United Airlines. Now, in that press conference, the attorney, Thomas Demetrio, said United's never reached out to my client, never reached out to me. United came back, fired off a statement almost immediately after saying, yeah, we did. We reached out multiple times. So there's a little back and forth going on there as well.
Yeah, that's interesting because while we have seen Munoz,
mm-hmm.
we've seen his apology and his talk about how badly this was handled. Or at first, he was a little resilient, or, you know, he was like behind the employees. Mm-hmm. Now he's sort of changing his tone. Everybody seems to be changing their tone. The president is flip flopping on things. The United Airlines guy is flipping and flopping on things. That's fine. So he sort of changed his tone a little bit, but I suppose it would have been a good idea for him to pick up the phone and personally call this guy.
And according to a statement released by United, they did. CEO Munoz actually did try or attempt to get on the phone with him.
Pick up a couple of phone lines. My number is 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. This is just a little soap opera we're watching. It matters a lot to this family. I'm not sure that it needs to matter a lot to you and me. I can't imagine what sort of changes this is going to result in. For instance, people should be dragged off airplanes sometimes. You know, they said, we'll never do this again. I didn't even like that statement. I think if somebody is dangerous or belligerent and they're not going to get off the plane, drag their butts off the plane. You don't owe me that promise. I'm not going to hold you to that. Now, maybe they shouldn't have dragged this guy off. Fine. But I'm not exactly sure that they need to say this will never happen again, because I suspect it will.
Well, and Attorney Demetrio kind of said, and this is the way that they're framing it, you can see the lawsuit as it's kind of unfolding in front of our eyes, that airline passengers, and this might be open for a bigger discussion, are bullied. They're bullied by the airlines. They're bullied by security. This entire process is, you know, these industries flexing their muscles at a time that should be relaxing, people going on vacation. But instead, it's very nerve-wracking, and people feel like they're being taken advantage of.
Well, I don't know what my problem is, Ryan. I'm just so on the airline side on this one. I see how badly they handled it. But I think that air travel is a anxious enterprise for passengers. Even the seasoned flyer is probably just a little more nervous about that than they are in a ride in an Uber. So there you are, sitting in an airplane. And if somebody acts oddly in an airplane, you immediately get tense. And if somebody shrieks or yells or is using a lot of volume in the airplane, you go, now what's that all about? Hey, come on, settle down. We're trying to fly here. Mm-hmm. So I don't want anybody to relax on the safety precautions or the restrictions. If you want to fly on an airplane, which you do not have a right to do, then I think you should conform your behavior to the group. And if the group said you got to get off and that's not fair, get off. If nothing else, just behave in as civil a manner as you can muster. That's me. Okay, let's take a couple phone calls. We'll start with Jerry. You're on WGN. Hey, Jerry, what do you want to say?
I want to say I think this doctor that had himself dragged off this United flight, what, a week ago, was doing a publicity stunt, such as he did this to impress a woman, or maybe he's gay and be a man. But anyway, he's like using a song lyric, like they drag you by your feet, but the hangman isn't hanging, so they put you on the street. I'll just explain later. I'm a doctor, and I won't get in any trouble. That's what I think he was doing. And, you know, this, I want to make a comment about Dow Chemical in Michigan. They make dioxin.
Okay. No. Hold on. We're not talking about Dow Chemical in Michigan. Thank you for the call, Jerry. I appreciate your thoughts. That's just another angle on it I hadn't heard. I know. I'll bet he's gay.
I don't know what...
You need not respond to that.
Okay.
You need not respond to that.
I do want to point out, we did learn a couple extra things, too. He was on the flight with his wife at that time. And the question was she also asked to leave? And they said after this whole thing blew up, yes, she was asked to leave.
Sure, I understand that. But I do think that if you look at the, the list of passengers, mm-hmm. you should not separate a couple. If I book the flight with my wife or my son... You shouldn't separate a family.
We didn't get clarity on whether or not both of them were of these four people who are not. They didn't seem to have all the answers for that, at least the attorneys.
Kevin, what did you want to say? You're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. Great show. I liked the topic. You guys, going through this. My question is, so an airplane, I think, is just like a ship. So as the captain, and I know the airplane, once the captain is... I believe aboard the plane, or certainly en route, he's the law.
Yep.
And what he says goes. So my question is, apparently they were still able to board the plane. Was he then in charge of, you may board my plane as the police officers and remove this?
Right. Was the airline pilot in charge of the security detail getting on board? Right. Do you know about that, Ryan?
This was the exact question that was posed by the attorney for Mr. Dow today. He said the exact same line, essentially, that it is a ship and the pilot should be the one in charge. Why was the pilot not the one making the call? Why was it United Airlines? Why was it the CDA that got involved in this? Why was the pilot completely left out of this?
But or is he saying that the man in charge of the plane, if we are upset, Steve Bertrand thinks that the real problem here isn't the passenger or the pilot, it's the security detail. But if the pilot is in charge of the craft, then ultimately responsibility goes back to United and the pilot. It's United's problem, even if it was the Chicago police or the security at O'Hare that did that. You understand the point?
Yeah, I get it. And there will be a Chicago Department of Aviation aspect to this as well. I don't think this lawsuit, when it comes down, will only be targeted at United, but even perhaps the city of Chicago.
It's 1:22. You got another minute to sit with us?
Yep.
Ryan Burroughs from WGN Radio News at that press conference, along with all of the reporters in the United States who were there today, all of them wearing at least slacks, nary a one of them with blue jeans. Am I right?
Cannot wear jeans at Union Club.
What happens if you wear jeans to a press conference at the Union Club?
House pants. You don't want those.
I will pick it up here in a minute on WGN. On WGN, I'm John Williams. Ryan Burrow from WGN Radio News was at the Three Ring Circus today, called the Thomas Dimitriou Show, in which he at least announced some of the things he is interested in defending Dr. Dow. Again, it is not an official civil suit yet. This is him just doing something.
part of it is, too. I mean, he's been getting hounded. They've all been getting hounded. The family's been getting hounded. And he's hoping that this creates a little bit of breathing room with a little bit of information. We got an update on the health, obviously. We kind of found out where they're going, where they're leaning to as far as a lawsuit. And we got a little bit of reaction from, how they're dealing with United and what kind of interaction or lack of interaction they're having.
Hey, Larry, you're on WGN. What's your question? Hi.
Yes, I just have a comment. that's happened in the last year or two. Nobody has any respect for security, police, or anything. You know, everybody wants to cause a commotion, and then a week or two later, you know darn well they're going to sue like crazy. Anybody that gets causes a disturbance is going to sue and collect. People should be more respectful. They should obey whatever security or ever any police or anything, and then resolve it later. But you know there's going to be a lawsuit. So I'm totally in favor of what the airlines did. So,
that's an interesting call. You bet. Thanks, Larry. How about Frank? You're on WGN. Frank, what did you want to say? Hi.
Hey, John. Good to hear you back on the radio.
Thank you, sir.
My comment was that a lot of people are criticizing that Mr. Dow didn't respond to Mr. Munoz's apology, his sincere apology. Mr. Dow is exploring the legal avenue now, and Mr. Munoz basically is speaking on behalf of the airport security, United Airlines. So he's basically a spokesperson for them, and he's apologizing for what someone else did. Mr. Dow was nearly 70 years old. The way they manhandled him, the way they dropped him, I've seen several different videos that have been circulating, and they dropped him on his face, which caused the broken teeth and the broken nose. What would have happened? Let's say hypothetical. What would have happened if this man would have died during this process? How would we look at our system the way that we treat each other then?
It's a good question. Thanks for the call. I think we'd look differently at it. You'd hear a completely different tone from me. I'll say that. Karen, you're on WGN. What do you want to say? Hi.
Hi, and it's good to hear you again.
Thank you.
You know, I flew United about 2 weeks ago, and I remember thinking to myself, wow, this went very well. People got on, there was room in the overhead, and so on, smiling flight attendants and this and that. Now, it had nothing to do with the flight attendants, with the doctor. But if it was me who was pulled out, all right, I would have had every bone in my body broken.
Well, what would you have done if they came on the plane and said, you have to get off?
I would start to cry. You know, and maybe that's the woman in me coming out.
No, but that's not answering the question I'm asking. If the police come on and say, oh, Karen, this sucks, but you've got to get off for the crew.
I would get off, John, because we've watched what happens if you don't listen to the police when they tell you to put your hands on the steering wheel. We've seen how it goes down fast. I think the level of anger is so it's up to a 9. I don't care if it's a flight situation or, you know, if it's in a store, you know, people just go ballistic immediately.
Yeah, Karen's right about that. Karen, thank you for the call. Ryan, any last comment from you?
Nope. We'll see how this goes legally, what avenue they'll be taking, whether or not they see this as some kind of unnecessary force that was used. That might be the way that the direction they kind of go after this.
Ryan Burrow from WGN Radio News was at that press conference today. We've got more news coming up on GN. 1:39. Thank you, Kim. John Williams here. And we can get more information about that bombing in Afghanistan coming your way a little later on in the 2 o'clock hour. Also, there was an article on CNN today about how the president is, I'll say flip-flopping, but I don't think they're judging it as necessarily all that bad, but changing his position on a number of things. China, are they a currency manipulator or not? Russia, is that a good country we should be pals with or bad? And the list goes on of things the president has seemingly changed his mind on, sometimes in a day. So what's going on there and what should we make of it? Chris Saliza joins us as a CNN editor after 2 o'clock, and he said, you know, well, I'll let him finish that after 2 o'clock. President Jefferson may be joining us in the next hour as well. We'll ask him what he thinks about the United Airlines story. But first, this is just a personal subject for me. But I've been telling you over the last couple of weeks, having moved from Minneapolis back to Chicago, currently staying temporarily in a condo downtown, that my wife and I are home or condo shopping, and it's been quite the revelation for me. Chicago's the city that works. No, Chicago is the city that walks up flights of stairs. If you're living in a condo or one of those walk-ups in the city, it's just I had no idea how vertical the living conditions are for people that live in the city.
So it keeps us all so thin.
It's how you look so good, Steve. You're all in rock solid shape because out in the suburbs where we got room for a riding lawnmower, for crying out loud, we don't have to go up steps like that. Okay. But Steve, nice to see you in the newsroom studio. Remember the other day I was saying that I felt a little
Yes.
betrayed by virtual staging?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how you defended it?
I did. I said it was the new thing. But, I mean, then you got into some cases of manipulation, which went a little far. But
well, okay, so here's what they do. When you buy a house, they first of all want you to clean out your stuff or make it as neutral as possible so other people can imagine their lives and stuff in there. I get that. And then sometimes you have a company and they'll stage it so it's most attractive to those potential buyers. But then they do something now called virtual staging where they're digitally painting walls and putting in ping pong tables ain't there at all.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was sort of a bait and switch for the potential buyer.
Can I tell you, I didn't realize this. I was talking with you about it. I went home, talked to Sharon, my wife, and we just went through a purchase of a condo. And she pointed out that it was staged. So they had a double bed in there, and there's not room for a double bed in the room.
Yeah.
So they must have doctored the picture to look like there was a bigger bed in there and was room for it than there is.
I saw a dining room today online, and the table, when I started to look at it, I went, no, that they've shrunk the table. It was like a Barbie doll table inside this picture. Okay, so we reached out to Mike Callahan, who is the owner of Show Homes in Fox Valley. You, Mike, are a stager, correct?
That is correct.
Do you use digital staging?
We do not.
Why not?
For all of the reasons you just said. You pretty much nailed it. One of the things that we have found is people can identify something tangible in front of them, but something virtual, once they get into the home, they've completely lost context.
I suppose if you wanted to say, hey, here's what a sofa looks like, and the people don't have a nice sofa, dropping one digitally in there is not the worst crime, right? I mean, if they're physically staging it,
right,
that they didn't own that, but you brought it in for them, right?
Correct.
So I wonder what the rules are, because in my case, they painted a floor or cleaned up the floor. The floor wasn't as nice as it looked online because they just put in gleaming hard wood when it wasn't there. And they painted the walls a nice color. It looked spotless because it was, you know, digital. I got in there and I went, these aren't the walls I saw online, Jack.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what the rules are of engagement here, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Because we're not involved in the virtual side for all of these reasons and a variety of others, I have even understood that in some states, actual virtual is illegal, that the realtors have come to agreement. And now I may be misspeaking there, no, so I'm sure someone will correct me if that's right. But I have heard that in states it's just not allowed.
Well, I've seen on some of the ads or postings, it'll say digital, you know,
correct,
some digital staging, or we might have digitally staged this. You can tell when the piano legs don't cast a shadow,
yes,
that maybe they were dropped in there. But what's key then? If you're selling your house, what are some of the things that you should do to make your house most attractive to a buyer?
Well, clearly, there are a couple of things to start with. And one of the things we call the three D's of staging, and that is decluttering. That's a huge issue. Depersonalizing.
Wait, they won't love my stuff? Because I love my stuff. And all our friends love my stuff.
Everybody loves your stuff except for buyers.
Yeah, okay.
And that's the reality. We go through and have to tell people, I'm sorry, that Hummel collection needs to go. That's not creating any value in your home.
Oh, so you don't like Hummels. Is that what you're saying?
I am.
Who are you to judge my Hummel collection?
I know. So it really is just to try to appeal to the most buyers. So decluttering.
Depersonalizing
and deep cleaning. Deep cleaning is so critical. What you just said, those are things that happen. You walk into a house and you think it should be clean. You would think somebody's trying to sell their home, and that's not always the case. So those are really the three first key components. And then from there, you look at first impression. What do you look at? Curb appeal, and then go in from there.
So what do you do to spruce up the first impression?
We will work with our designers. We'll go out and actually meet with the homeowners, meet with the clients, and let them know exactly what they would suggest to tidy up the front space. We just completed a very nice home in St. Charles, a very high-end home. We had them paint the front door. We had them paint the entry. It had kind of an alcove entry. It was
what color did they paint the front door?
Well, we went with my wife, the designer is here. It matched some of the colors in the brick.
Oh, yeah.
She had some brick facade.
I like red doors. That's all I'm saying.
This had a red door on it, but it looked inappropriate because the house was green.
Oh.
So it didn't match. It's a beautiful home, but now it's got this beautiful brown, darker than wood, really good. And then we painted the alcove white, so it just pops.
What if some people get very creative and imaginative. It's their house. They get to do whatever they want.
Sure.
So you'll see some bright colors or sometimes some dramatically dark colors in rooms. You'd probably discourage that, right? You can live that way, but it's harder to sell your house that way. So do you tell them to paint those walls?
We do. We do. And it's up to them, of course, what they are willing to do. But the fact of the matter is those colors are emotional colors. So somebody walking into a dark home, people are not buying dark. Quite honestly, in the 80s, dark was an okay thing.
Yeah, but right. What color should you paint the walls in?
The walls should be neutral. They should be, you know, a couple of our favorite colors are agreeable gray and accessible beige. And they're both very neutral, and they allow you to really decorate with any color. That's where your color comes in, is in your decorating, in your pillows or in your setting of the table or things like that. You give the personality, and the color comes through in that way.
Yeah, right. And then what about beautiful works of art that you love?
That's a great question.
Because I have seen some really lousy art, and I've seen some beautiful art.
We're going to store most of that beautiful art. That's going to go in the storage facility while we put something more on trend and more transitional in style. We do want to keep pace with the feel of the home, though. We don't want to completely lose the feel of the
home. Well, this is the thing. That's what's bothered me, having bought and sold homes over the years, is that I'm not kidding when people say, oh, I like your house, John. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like my house, you, the potential buyer, I'll pass on you and gamble that the next person will, that they will see my bookshelves filled with books and stuff and go, wow, what a great idea. I'm getting a warm feeling here. And while I don't own these books and stuff, are you with me on this, Tom?
I'm following.
I can imagine my stuff living this way. So rather than strip it out, let's give the home a little personality. What do you think of that?
That's exactly what we do.
Oh, you do? That's okay. I thought you were going to tell me, no, take all this stuff off your
Well, I'm going to tell you to take half of it out because people need to know that there's you're selling space. You're not selling your books. Your books are not going to stay. You haven't read them anyway, so you may as well take them with you to the next location and let them be there. But the fact of the matter is storage space is really critical, and buyers want to know that. Closets, three-quarters empty, or I'm sorry, a quarter empty, three-quarters full. Shelves should be about a half because buyers want to know that the home has plenty of space to store their stuff.
I look in the closets shopping for a home or a condo in Chicago, and I got news for you. There's no closet space in Chicago.
This is true.
I mean, not in the, if you have a building that was built 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, I don't know. People were smaller and they had less stuff back then, but they don't have any room in these places. And the people that are building or rehabbing condos or homes in Chicago are, I think, robbing Peter and paying Paul. They're taking what could be closet space, and they're trying to get every last square foot out of the floor plan. But then, so I've got a bigger bedroom now,
right,
but I don't have room for my clothes in the closet. It was very frustrating to me.
Very frustrating. And that is, I mean, those are architectural and geometric issues that really, they are what they are.
Yeah.
A lot of people, a lot of our clients that we work with, particularly in the city when we have that, is we'll very often put a wardrobe in there if the room is big enough so
some
that
of
you
them
have
need
some
that.
Storage. Yes.
It's 148. Okay. Actually, a member of the city council who passed an ordinance about this has just called in. I'm glad that he did. We'll pick it up here in a minute on WGN. On WGN, this is John Williams. The news at the top of the hour. There is some interesting, fascinating, curious news about this gigantic bomb that we've dropped in Afghanistan on what are believed to be some ISIS strongholds, a network of tunnels. What sort of damage did it do, and what does all of this mean? I don't know yet. More news in 8 minutes, and we'll talk to an analyst about the MOAB after the 2 o'clock WGN radio news. So as I've been shopping for a home in the Chicago area, I've been sharing some of my observations with you, and we actually asked a stager to come into our studio. Is that the right description of you, Mike? Is that what you are?
That is correct. We own a staging company that predominantly works out in the western suburbs, but we actually work in the city as well.
Show Homes in Fox Valley. Now, Jack called in. Hey, Jack, this is John. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. How you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Let me clarify something. First, I'm not on the city council any longer. I was. When I was on there, I got aggravated because the developers that were building houses, et cetera, also selling condominiums, etc., would show in brochures these pictures, these beautiful pictures of these the landscaping on the outside of the home and on the inside of the home, and it looked nothing like that when the development was finished. So I presented to the city council at the time, this is in Palatine, and we discussed it, and we decided that any brochures that were being presented by the companies, that were, anybody that was selling any property, any company that was selling a new piece of property, used one, had to present any brochures to the city council for approval as part of the plan unit development. And the reason for it was because they show beautiful trees and grass and things like that.
Yeah.
And then when they buy the home, it looked like crap that they didn't put in any
trees. No landscaping. And the justification is, yeah, but that's what it will look like someday when you do it. Won't this be swell? But I've always felt, Jack, that was a bait and switch.
Well, and then, you know, and that's the exterior staging. Then they would do the same thing on the inside. Just think about this. We passed a policy saying that they could not have demo homes or properties they were showing that they altered. For instance, ask this gentleman that you have on there for staging, especially the new ones. They take the doors off, and then they show beautiful furniture that fits in the room. Well, once you put the doors on, you can no longer put the furniture.
Okay, hold on a second. I never thought about that.
We have staged a whole lot of model homes. I've never run into one where we had to take a day off or a door off. The furniture.
No, but if you did, then that, and then you show that furniture in there, again, that's
right.
Something I'm showing you that you can't do, that you
yes.
won't have.
Right.
That seems to be, I don't know that you need to create an ordinance about that, but evidently Jack felt strongly enough about it to fight that fight. Jack, it's very interesting. Thank you for the phone call. Somebody else wanted to know the names of those colors which you think people should put up on their walls. The neutral ones, what did you say?
It was accessible beige and agreeable gray, and those are Benjamin Moore colors.
Yeah, okay. Any last things you want to just pass along for folks buying and selling to look for or to do?
Go Cubs. Going to go with that. And you know what? The 3Ds are critical. I mean, it's first. It doesn't matter. First impression, second impression. It's the only impression. You need the house to show like you want it to sell. And that's going to take the 3Ds, the depersonalizing, the decluttering, the cleaning. But beyond that, we would love to, and any professional stager would love to help you with it beyond that.
Yeah. Well, I've seen pictures, too, where some people, you know, I'm not sure that you need to hire a professional photographer. Your realtor will be happy to bring in their person, and they're the photographer, and they're going to take the pictures. And I've often said that, but then when they took the pictures of our house, I thought they looked dynamite, and I know I could not have done that well. I've also seen online pictures that people are posting, and some of them, like one of them, they had a bag of garbage still sitting there.
Yep.
Or they have dishes still in the sink. Maybe that shows how people live in the place, but I'm not sure that that's what they should have done. It's remarkable to me how bad some of the pictures are. I presume taken by the owners, but they're on the MLS. And I thought, who is helping these people, you know?
It's a sad commentary. I go through the MLS every morning kind of looking for vacant homes and things like that. And it is amazing the photos you see. Now, those are typically, the realtor is usually in charge of that, and they've either paid for it or they've hired somebody out. And I know that they don't have a chance to see everyone, but some of them really are bad. But, you know, in life, things fall out sometimes. But the ones with dishes in the sink, we saw one the other day, literally the kids were sitting at the kitchen table eating cereal. It was a little bit of an embarrassment.
Well, that's a kind of staging. What you do is you get really attractive kids to be eating life cereal with fresh fruit and grains in front of them. And you can imagine that would be you someday if you just bought this house.
Mikey likes it.
Yeah,
there you go.
Maybe not. Mm-hmm. Well, nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us in studio. Again, it's Show Homes in Fox Valley. Mike Callahan, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
NATO is obsolete. It's costing us too much money. It's too much, and frankly, it's a different world. Mm-hmm. I said it was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete.
Wait a minute. That was something different. He didn't change his mind, did he? It's 208. I'm not against changing your mind. I think that's not always a bad thing. Sometimes circumstances change, and you should change with it. And the phrase flip-flop seems to always be negative. If I say you flip-flopped on something, well, then you willy-nilly changed your mind, you were disingenuous or dumb, and that's a bad thing. I don't mean that. I just trying to look for a better phrase to describe what the president seems to be doing on so many issues. And that's been a topic today that touches a lot of what we're talking about. I mean, the president said that China was a currency manipulator. Now he said, you know, actually, we're not going to label them a currency manipulator. He said we would never bomb Syria or shouldn't. And lo and behold, we launched 59 Tomahawk missiles into Syria last week because of a video that we all saw. The president has said that Russia was somebody we should reach out to. Why wouldn't we want to be friends with Russia? And now he said Russia is not our friend. We've never been at a lower point. And the list goes on. There was a piece on CNN today, and it said, an easy way to understand Trump's recent flip-flops. It was written by an editor-at-large who has worked for a number of news organizations you've heard about, including, I believe, Washington Post, Chris Cillizza, CNN editor-at-large. He joins us now on line number 7 on WGN. Hi, Chris. It's John Williams. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for the expert last name pronunciation.
Cillizza.
Yeah, perfect.
I put you,
years of homeroom teachers you've now leaped ahead of.
You know, if you were in radio, your last name would be Williams. I got news for you.
It's so true. Honestly, I think sometimes in my chosen profession, I should change my last name to Smith.
It would work, at least if you want to do radio interviews. So is this Donald Trump not knowing what his position should be and he's just changing it as circumstances go, or give me your read on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a really good point that I think the sort of cynical political class should always keep in mind, which is we want people leading us. We want people in general who, when new information comes in, it affects how they view something. We don't necessarily want people who are rigid about everything, and whatever view you had at the start is what view you have at the end. So I do think that that's an important point to make. The thing I would say with as it regards Trump, I think, and I pick Syria and maybe put this out. I mean, I understand how, you know, photos of children and civilians being gassed could really impact how you view something. But you mentioned a lot of these other things, China currency manipulation being one, our stance as it relates to Russia being another, his views on Janet Yellen saying during the campaign that she was doing a terrible job, now she's saying she's doing a good job. The issue I think there for Trump is there's not that obvious piece of evidence or evolution in his thinking. It's just sort of like, I said this one thing then, and it was true then, and now I'm saying this over here, and it's true now. And that, to me, is that middle part that is important to have as it relates to, oh, okay, I sort of understand why a reasonable person would reconsider their position.
Okay, but if Janet Yellen was the example, on the campaign trail, he didn't say, boy, I'm going to take a hard look at her because I'm not sure. He said she should go. He was unequivocal on the campaign trail about all of these issues. And now, like you say, he staked out a middle ground and he's actually coming on the other side on some of these things.
Yes.
But in your piece on CNN.com today, you said that as the negotiator, this is really his MO. This is him saying maybe something about China's currency manipulation is a way to maybe get some concessions from them down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when it comes to Trump, I actually think there was, particularly within the Republican base, some level of misunderstanding about who he is at root. I think there was some sense that he was sort of an arch ideological conservative. And honestly, there wasn't all that much evidence for that in the first place, outside of sort of tonally when it came to the wall and, you know, we need to be tougher in the country. But from a policy perspective, his history didn't suggest that that's who he was.
Right.
I think who he really is, from what we know of his entire life, right, not just this almost 2 years in politics, but who he really is someone who sort of makes deals, cuts deals. That's what he does. That's who he is. Everything is a negotiation. And I think that is up to and including the positions he takes on issues. And I think we see that happening, you know, on a daily basis here with a lot of people not necessarily understanding it, but that's what we see happening.
And that's too bad for Republicans, isn't it? Because they made the deal with this devil who's branded himself as a Republican, and he has all of the Republican support. I mean, he's a Republican president, but he really doesn't espouse necessarily Republican views all along. And I think he taints their brand when he says or does things that are dumb or insensitive or just flat out wrong or untruthful. I mean, all of those bad things that Donald Trump does fall on the Republican side of the ledger. And I actually don't think it is fair to plenty of good Republicans who are either members of Congress or who are just citizens. You know, if you espouse Republican values, which to me at least economically means you're conservative, I think a lot of us support that. Too bad for you. This is your standard bearer.
Well, I mean, in many ways, it's what I always say to people is it's not as though I feel like Donald Trump didn't really, particularly from a tonal perspective, it's not as though he pretended he was something he was not. Now, on issues, I think you are right. I think it could have been obvious earlier to astute Republicans, particularly people in elected office, that his history would not suggest that he is a Ted Cruz, for example, conservative. He was a Democrat until a few years ago. He's much more of a populist than he is anything else. And while populism is related to both parties, Mike Huckabee ran as a populist for Republicans. Bill Clinton ran as a populist for Democrats. So I think there was and the other thing I'd say is I do remember there was a lot of resistance to Donald Trump being the Republican nominee. Now, maybe not among the activist base, but among sort of the professional political class. There was a real effort there.
Well, Paul Ryan didn't want him. Reince Priebus didn't want him.
Right. The issue they ran into was the voters wanted him, and that at some point they sort of acceded to that. But, yes, I think it makes it difficult because – I think we're kind of existing. We've existed for a long time on a basic continuum where one poll is liberalism or Democrats and the other poll is conservatives and Republicans. The thing is that Donald Trump does not fit on that axis. Donald Trump is sort of off that axis. He's not even really in between it. He's just in a different place. And I think that makes it difficult if you are a sort of establishment Republican to position yourself vis-a-vis him over time.
You can't.
They're just grappling with now.
Well, all right, but so the question now is, what is the U.S. policy on X? What is U.S. policy on Russia? What is U.S. policy on Syria? And one day it seemed to be one thing, one day it seemed to be another. And if I understand correctly, Chris, your view is that's the way it is when you have a poker player. That's the way you have it when you've got a real estate wheeler dealer. He's just going to keep cutting deals. And if you go, no, I thought we liked Russia. Well, now we don't like Russia. Well, he's just going to keep being hot and cold until he gets what he thinks is the best deal for the U.S. Is that, I mean, correct?
That's right. And I also think that there's a day-to-day sense for this presidency. I learned this during the campaign that, you know, Donald Trump would say or do something one day and everyone would pronounce the long-awaited pivot to the general election or the pivot to being more presidential or the pivot to something. And at the end of the day, the sun would come up the following day and it would be sort of that last day didn't happen, or he would do something that contradicted that last time. And I really do think this is a day-to-day presidency, that one, what happens on today, Thursday, is not necessarily predictive of what will happen tomorrow. It's certainly not predictive of what will happen a week from now. I don't know any other conclusion that we could draw given the evidence that we currently have.
Still trying to figure out if that's a good thing or not. I mean, like, if Russia can't figure him out or Syria can't figure him out or China can't figure him out, maybe that caginess is good. But I've got health care bills to pay, and I want to know what the U.S. policy is going to be on that. And I can't have a guy say one thing one day and something else the next. And I don't know that I need to worry about the wall, but boy, they're all over the map on where that is going these days. He seems to have changed his view on that many times. Now, I don't know who he's negotiating with there, but we're the ones that are going to have to pay for it. So I'm scratching my head a little bit about this, Chris. I'll pause. We'll come back in a minute. You may want to be part of the conversation, too. President Flip-Flop is the topic. The number is 312-981-7200, and this is WGN. It's a 22,000-pound bomb, largest in the arsenal that's not nuclear. Never been used before. Not a good thing or a bad thing. That's just what it is. What does it mean? We'll talk about that after 2:30. It's 2:22 right now. We're finishing a conversation with Chris Cillizza. He is a editor-at-large at CNN. He has a piece today that said, an easy way to understand Trump's recent flip-flops. It's enough to A, give you whiplash, he wrote, and B, raise legitimate questions about what Trump actually believes, given that many of his current positions are directly at odds with those that he staked out during the campaign. Is this a new Trump, a more centrist, realistic one? And if so, what's changed? The answer is that nothing, he writes, has really changed. This has been the master negotiator, if you will, all along. By the way, Chris, does that make you an ally? Are you an advocate? Are you a fan of this president? Are you neutral on this president?
No, neither. Yeah, no. Studiously neutral.
Take a couple
but
of...
I always say an interested observer. I am a fan of politics.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where you should be, at least for my purposes. Let Sharon jump in here and ask a question. You're on WGN. Hi, Sharon.
I just feel that the Trump that was the politician didn't really know the facts. He was doing things like a lot of the rest of us, what we hear in the news, et cetera. And now he's finding out what really are the facts, what really he has to change his mind because he didn't know all the facts and nuances, et cetera, that he knows now. So I give him that much. But the other thing that bothers me is that he may be doing things militarily. He said he would do things without telling people, et cetera. But I'm concerned, how far is he going to go in overriding what the Constitution requires him to do?
It's an interesting point, Sharon. Thanks for the call. You know, with respect to this bomb that we're going to hear more about, can't you just see Donald Trump saying, we're going to fight ISIS? I'll show you how bad we're going to fight ISIS. This is the guy who everything has to be a superlative, right? We're not just going to send in special ops, or we're not just going to bomb a place. We're going to send in the biggest bomb the planet has that's not nuclear. That'll show them. And even if it doesn't show them, it shows you that he's the big, strong guy. And I hate for that sort of schoolyard ethos to be the way the president of the United States is operating. Then it gets scary, Chris.
It does, although I'm not sure. I don't think we know nearly enough at this point in terms of how that decision was made to make that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Call.
Does the president make the call on the dropping of a bomb like this? Steve, I'll bet you don't know in the newsroom, right? Or is that completely a military decision?
He said during his little the brief comments earlier that he had given his Pentagon generals all the authority to do what they needed.
That's right.
Tended to imply that they made the call. I don't know.
Yeah, he said, everybody knows exactly what happened. So what I do is authorize our military. We have given them total authorization, and that's what they're doing, which would suggest that, I guess the answer is he's not saying if he personally said, let's do it or
okay.
not.
Okay, let me throw in a couple of quick, go ahead, finish that thought, Chris.
Of course. No, I was just going to say, I do think, I don't want to say he deserves credit, but I do think that this is, because I'm not in the credit or blame giving at this point, but I do think this is something that does stand in contrast to Trump's last week, which is, this is him doing something, which is dropping, a bomb on what they believe is a camp, a suspected ISIS camp in Afghanistan. He talked a lot during the campaign about how we needed to be tougher on ISIS, and that would be his first priority.
This is Jan. What did you want to say, Jan? You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Well, I'm going to say something that maybe you won't like, but I have personal experience with my family. I'm a member of a family that has many older adults. Some have passed on since. But as a nation, I think we are dealing with a person who is entering dementia in a big way. He's waking up every morning like a chicken. It's a brand new day every day for him, and he doesn't really know what is going on. He doesn't have the background. He doesn't have the experience. He has really no idea what he's doing in this office.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Jan. I think a lot of us wondered about his mental health at various times. I haven't heard it put that way. Thank you for the call. I'm going to go from you to Stan, and then we'll wrap this up. Stan, you're on the air. What did you want to say?
Yeah, how you doing there, John? I just don't understand. Like, I'm listening to your guests. It seems like I hear people
falling over themselves, tripping over everything in their way to make Trump smarter than what he is. They're saying that he's planned this or this is the way he worked. And I bet you none of them even knew the way he worked before he was even in got this position. They just, I just don't understand it.
Yeah, no, I get you, Stan. I appreciate your call. We wanted to hear a few more voices. We've got this update from ABC News coming up at the bottom of the hour in Steve Bertrand's news. So, Stan, I'll say goodbye to you. Chris, I'll say goodbye to you. You can read him at CNN.com, and let's visit another day, Chris.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be on.
It's 2:28. This is WGN. I was talking to one of my producers today, Steve, and she said, I didn't know anything about this bomb. It wasn't in the papers. And I said, yeah, well, they don't normally advertise that they're going to drop a bomb on Afghanistan. But it is the sort of thing that you think, okay, if this is going to be the start of something big, if this is us going forward in some way, wow, I didn't know we were going to be doing that. They don't need to tell you or me that, but I didn't know we were going to be doing that.
Yeah, well, there's been talk of this bomb before.
I've heard of the bomb.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that we were going to begin a campaign in Afghanistan.
You know, we were talking in here and about, well, does the president approve everything? He's like, well, we have a lot of missions going on. Look, that's in Afghanistan. The government today said they mistakenly killed, I think it was 18 friendly fighters in Syria. There's limited action in Iraq. I mean, there is military action from the U.S. in several parts of the Middle East
right now. I'll feel better about all of this if you tell me that the president wasn't the decider on this, that this was a military campaign, that we thought we knew where these caves were and these tunnels, and we thought we had to eliminate them. And if Hillary Clinton was president or anybody was president, this was probably going to happen anyway. I will feel better about that if that's the case.
I wouldn't say that's the case. I will say that I'm sure that that he wasn't going over the maps and picking spots, you know, that it was suggested by his military experts or recommended by his military experts. Well, I don't know that a different administration would do the same policy.
Well, maybe I'm not stating my point clearly then. I would prefer that they came to him and said, Mr. President, here's these caves and tunnels.
I'm sure that's...
We need to take them out. We need your approval to use this amazingly powerful bomb. And he said, if that's what you guys think you need to do, you go do it. I'm okay with that. I'm not okay with it going the other way.
You mean like with him with Google Maps in the Oval Office finding this spot?
Something like he says, you know what, we need to send a message to ISIS.
Okay.
Go get that big bomb, that one that we use a cargo plane and we push it out the back door. Go get that one and let's find a place and blow it up. And they'd say, okay, now we're going to find, we found a reasonable target, sir. I prefer it not be the way I just
described. So you're saying the bomb before the target.
I want the military to make the call and even them to be the initiator of this idea, not the president.
I can't answer that. I hope you're right. I mean, I hope that's the case.
Yeah. Okay. More about that in a few minutes. By the way, every now and then we, on my show, reach out to our old friend Thomas Jefferson, and we had him scheduled today, but maybe we'll keep this conversation a little shorter because of the news. Mr. Jefferson, are you there?
Citizen.
Oh, good day. How are you, Thomas Jefferson? Happy birthday to you.
I'm feeling pretty old. You know, I was a vegetarian, and I took very good care of myself, but I was born in 1743, so I'm feeling elderly.
Yeah, well, I think for how old does that make you then today? 1743, you add all that up, by a couple hundred and a half. You sound pretty good to me, sir.
Well, I took care of myself, so I kept my teeth until the end. I was one of the rare founding fathers who brushed his teeth, and I also had the equivalent of flossing my teeth. I used toothpicks. I was more hygienic and fastidious than most of the people who lived during my generation.
I called you just to say hi, wish you happy birthday, remind our listeners that since I'm on weekdays now, I have a Monday through Friday, Saturday home on WGN again, that we'll invite you on once in a while, and we're going to continue to do our stage conversations. I have two visits coming up with presidents this year. One will be in August. That'll be, I don't know if you know this guy, Teddy Roosevelt. And then in December, boy, this would be a great Christmas gift or something like that. We're going to do a Christmas time show with you in December.
I can only say a couple of things about that. I don't know who this Roosevelt is. I died in 1826, but you know, you called to wish me happy birthday. I really kept my birthday very private. You know, people wanted to know because they wanted to have a national holiday or, you know, parades or people well-wishers turning up at Monticello or at the White House. And I don't want to sound like a stickler, but I was very much private about these things, and I refused to divulge it, and I didn't celebrate my birthday. I regard it as a merely arbitrary day in the calendar year. So I appreciate it, of course.
Well, you would hate your Facebook page today then.
Right.
Because everybody would just be saying happy birthday to you left and right.
We didn't do that in my time, and the, you know, the cult of celebrity, which has sprung up between my time and yours, is something that I would have found not only a little distasteful personally, but not really very healthy for a Republican democracy like our own.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you don't want to make too much of any person who happens to be the president of the United States. I happen to be the president for two terms between 1801 and 1809. George Washington was our first president. He's probably the only one that deserves that sort of celebration. And his birthday was well known in his lifetime. And there were days of celebration and fasting and prayer and pompous parades and so on surrounding it. I wanted to break with that when I became the third president.
Hmm. Still, I want to get you something. I could overnight it. Any suggestions? What would be a good birthday present for Thomas Jefferson?
A telescope.
You want a telescope?
You send me a telescope.
Why do you want a telescope?
Well, you have an eclipse coming up in August. An eclipse is a very rare thing, a total eclipse of the sun. And I observed one in 1778 at Monticello, but I didn't have an accurate chronometer. You need a very good timepiece. And I didn't really ever have adequate telescope. So that would be a wonderful gift, and I hope all of you will take time on the 21st of August of this year in your time to go out and observe a total eclipse of the sun. It's one of those moments where you realize that the Creator was a genius, a kind of a clockmaker who produced a solar system that runs in highly accurate ways. And because of that, you can actually predict those moments when there's a lunar eclipse or a solar eclipse or when there's something called mm-hmm. the transit of Venus. So I hope that would be a wonderful gift for you to send.
I was thinking about maybe a wine of the month. Thought you'd kind of like that.
That would be good. Bordeaux, please.
Yeah. Or a jelly of the month. We could send you Lou Malnati's Pizza. They have a Chicago pack. You'd get the Chicago hot dogs, the Italian beef, and some of this Chicago deep dish pizza. I'll bet you'd like that.
Maybe a sampler of 10 or 12 of these, and then I could decide which one seems most appropriate.
Maybe I could get you some Cubs gear. We're celebrating the Chicago Cubs up here, and the Blackhawks are in the playoffs tonight, so we're really stoked about that. You want maybe a Blackhawks jersey or hat or something like that?
I'm maybe thinking a loan from a bank. You know, I died very deeply in debt, and in my time there was very little credit to be had. I could use a debt consolidation loan.
Yeah, they have these cards now that have value in them. I could send you a small piece of plastic. Embedded in it would be $50, $100, $1,000, and then you could use that at stores like cash. I'll bet that would come in handy.
I'd like $108,000, please. That's what my debt was at the time of my death. That would be about $9 million in your currency, but I would be very pleased for $108,000 on a card.
I don't know that they have those at Walgreens, but I'll see. And if they do, Steve Bertrand might kick in, and Elif's probably got 10 extra bucks. Hey, Steve, TJ needs $108,000 if you want to put up one of those jars in the newsroom or something.
A prepaid, you know.
Does he get the whole Kickstarter thing?
Oh, that's right.
We could put up a campaign. He's got quite a record to raise funds on.
Yeah, we could do a GoFundMe page for you, Mr. President, where people do you just say, hey, it would be Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, still in debt, needs $9 million. Let's all help him out. He's the, you know, he wrote the Declaration of Independence.
Do that. That would seem selfish to me. But if you want to do a Kickstarter, the thing to do would be the University of Virginia. So I proposed it around 1816, and the legislature of Virginia was very unwilling to spend money on higher education, especially public higher education. And I had to work almost more strenuously than for any other project in my life to get that university funded. And I think a little Kickstarter campaign in my time would have been extremely valuable for an institution of that importance to the future of human liberty.
Well, they didn't have the internet then, so it'd be a little more difficult, but I think they could have publicly accrued funds for it somehow or another.
Well, we had to. It was very, very complex. And, of course, my tastes, you know, I wanted Palladian, brick, a neoclassical lawn, and this was a little bit too much for the for the taxpayers of Virginia. So I almost had to use a form of trickery to sort of get the foot in the door on the University of Virginia and then slowly bring up, by shame often, the House of Delegates to fund it at its proper level.
Well, let's do this. It's 2:47. It's good to hear you. Happy birthday to you. We'll put some Lou Malnati's gift pack in the mail for you. And let's stay in touch between now and certainly December when you come back to the Chicago area. We talk on stage again.
I'll be looking for the telescope. I appreciate it.
Yeah, he wants a telescope too, right? I forgot about that. It's 2:47. That's the third president of your United States. TJ, this is John Williams. Alep just handed me a sheet of paper to introduce my guest. She's found someone to talk to us a little bit more about this bomb, which we've exploded in Afghanistan, air warfare reporter at military.com. It's Oriana. Oriana, how do you pronounce your last name?
Pollock.
Pollock. I apologize for the lousy introduction. I was just handed this sheet of paper. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about what you know or what I should know about this ordnance that was exploded in Afghanistan.
Sure. So we dropped the GBU-43. It's called a MOAB, referred to as the mother of all bombs, but really it stands for the Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb. We dropped that today in Afghanistan in Nangarhar province, which borders Pakistan. And it's the first time we've ever used this bomb in combat, even though we've tested it previously in 2003, but never used it.
Tested it in 2003, so we know what it does. What does it do?
So it's meant to... It's meant to take out surface in a surface that is medium or soft. In this instance, we used it against ISIS that they were seen to be in this cave area, and that was meant to say, "Hey, here's our presence here. We've used this as a deterrent, and also just something that we don't want you to stay in this province."
So it's a sort of a demonstration of force.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I presume it's also used to accomplish something. What does it do on the ground? And is it exploded above and sends a shockwave down, or does it hit the ground and blow up?
So it would hit the ground being a massive ordnance air blast. It would hit the ground, like I said, soft to medium surface area. In this case, we took out some caves that ISIS, the faction in Afghanistan, was using, and it did send some shockwaves.
Shockwaves, and then I guess just make a huge hole, and hopefully if you hit the right spot, it disrupts that tunnel network they had or whatever, huh?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Would it ever be used? Is it anticipated to be used on civilians, or not civilians, but on humans? Like if there was an army staged on the front, would you drop it there, and what sort of damage would it do then?
So it would kill individuals in the vicinity, but in this instance, the officials in Afghanistan who deployed the weapon said that they avoided civilian casualties before they dropped the bomb out of an Air Force MC-130 Special Operations aircraft, which keeps the weapon inside a weapons cradle, and it takes the bomb out and deploys it. It has controllable fins that can guide the bomb, and it can hit something within 8 meters of the blast site.
Have you read anything or heard anything about how accurate the drop was then?
As of right now, they're still assessing what the impact was in this instance, but it has Sean Spicer, the White House correspondent, said today it was effective, and as did President Donald Trump came out and said it intended to hit ISIS in this area, and it was effective.
Hmm. Do you know much about how the decision is made to use this? Is this completely a military decision, or does the president have to sign off on the using of the mother of all bombs?
So in this instance, the president has given the military a little bit more leeway in this instance, and the president does not need to sign off on any kind of kinetic strike. That could be anything from a drone deploying hellfires to something in this instance as the mother of all bombs. In the last few weeks, we've actually seen President Trump give more authority to the military to use more kinetic strikes, and that has actually been in place for the last year and a half, even with the Obama administration. So it wouldn't necessarily need a sign-off from the president, and in this case, it did not.
We're all kind of, you know, marveling at the... I've seen pictures of it. We're marveling at the size of it, the weight of it, 22,000 pounds, and maybe the destructive force. Are we making too much out of that? Like, if we had dropped 2,000 bombs, I don't think I'd be worried about it or talking about it. Just give me some perspective, I guess, on this.
So... we have B-52 bombers in the area conducting strikes against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, for example. And that's an aircraft that can hold over 70,000 pounds of bombs, varying from GPS-guided or other variants of bombs. So there could have been an instance of which we used that. However, we didn't. We chose to go with the singular bomb that we haven't used in combat before, because when you do use a multitude of munitions, like, for example, in the B-52, that's very expensive to drop that many bombs, and especially during a time when the U.S. has gone through it's needing to replenish its bomb stock because it's actually in short supply.
Okay, one last thing about this, though. It does seem to be not surprising that the president, who said, "I'll show them, we're tough, we're strong," and is all about projecting strength, would choose to use this weapon over more conventional size weapons as a show of force, as a show of strength or resolve, say. I don't know if you have any comment on that, but I wonder if the use of this weapon is reflective of that.
Absolutely. I mean, in the last week, we have seen the Trump administration conduct Tomahawk cruise missile strikes in Syria against the Assad regime at the airbase. And just a week later, we have deployed this bomb that has never been used in combat before. Again, it was just tested in 2003 to be a deterrent to Saddam Hussein at the time. But now we've actually used it. There has been a week's worth of military might in this instance from the Trump administration. So it's meant to send a signal.
But this doesn't mean that we're ramping up a campaign or making greater inroads into Afghanistan, does it?
Well, we've been ramping up in Afghanistan for the last year and a half or so, but primarily from the air. Even though we have curtailed the number of troops on the ground from 10,000 to 8,000, we have been conducting an air war there for the last 15 years, absolutely. We have used F-16s to MQ-1 Reaper drones, and that's going on every single day. That has not stopped. So the ramp-up, you can view how many weapons we release via Air Force's Central Command, and we have been working in Afghanistan for quite some time. So this doesn't indicate necessarily a ramp-up, considering we've been there, and we have been conducting kinetic strikes within the last year and a half, more so.
Understood. Arianna Pollack, thank you for your time. Reporter at military.com, air warfare expert. We sure appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
At the Madhouse on Madison, Ro Khan, Anna DeVlantis, a host of guests and characters out there today. Hey, guys, how are you?
We couldn't be better, John. Now, as you can tell from the cavernous, hollow sound here.
You have your golf
at the Madhouse
on
Madison.
Yeah.
We are the only four people in the room right now.
Other than the people needed to get the United Center prep for tonight's big game.
It doesn't sound like a madhouse on Madison. Can I
just
say that?
It will be, though. 5 o'clock, the doors open, and that's when you can expect to hear lots of fan excitement here.
Yes.
The building.
That's our plan, at least.
Oh, that'll happen.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, are you talking like this, or will you be using your outside voices, indoor voices?
It's golf announcing is what we're doing here. We're sitting here quietly around the bend, around the 122 section.
Yes.
And Kevin Powell's addressing the hot dog stand.
He's got a mean right to left break here.
It does appear that he is going for the footlong. That's a controversial move here. Very aggressive. But,
extra mustard, please.
He's going for the relish. So that's what it's going to be like. A lot of that for the first hour. Actually,
but it'll get better from there.
Starting off, I know you were just talking, John, with an expert on what this Moab was. We're going to talk a little bit about what the political reaction is. And then Rocky Wirtz, he owns this franchise. He's going to be joining us a little bit later on the program as we celebrate the first day of the playoffs and our beloved Chicago Blackhawks. Thank you, John. Have a good day.
Thanks,
you
John.
You too. See you.